a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway station, running scared. Laying low, seeking out the poorer quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. Lie-la-lie. Asking only workmen's wages, I come looking for a job, but I get no offers. Just to come home from the wars on 7th Avenue. I do declare there were times when I was so lonesome I took some comfort there. La 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 la. Then I'm laying out my winter clothes and wishing I was gone, going home, where the New York City winters are bleeding me. Stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains.
That was Simon and Garfunkel and The Boxer. I'm Robert Washburn, and this is Consider This Live on The Drive Time. And I'm with David Sheffield, the community outreach worker for the Greenwood Coalition. And I'm welcoming him as my special guest tonight. Good to see you tonight, David.
Thanks for having me here, Robert. Good to be here.
Before we get going here, I think it's important to maybe paint a little bit of a picture of just we're going to be talking about poverty and we're going to be talking about homelessness. And in the Northumberland Poverty Reduction Action Committee's annual report for 2012 and 2013, it said Northumberland County has a population of 82,126 people, of which 12.1% live in poverty. Does that number surprise you, David?
It doesn't surprise me. It probably surprises some people in the community because in a rural community like this, a small town, people don't see the typical signs of poverty that that you see in a city or something like that. And so it tends to be a bit more hidden, and people don't recognize what it looks like in a small community.
As we're starting out here, can we talk a bit about the Greenwood Coalition? And let's start by, what is the Greenwood Coalition?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's not always a simple answer. But I think that at this point, after 8 years of existence in the community, I can say that the Greenwood Coalition itself is a community first. And it's a place that people can belong. People who are well off, people who are struggling with poverty can belong. And within that community, we try to find ways to make things work better and improve the well-being of all of us, because we kind of recognize that if some of us are struggling, we're all being held back by that.
Interesting. You said that it's not just people who are impoverished or homeless, but that it's a broader community. Can you describe the kinds of people that come out and are involved in your events?
Well, we have very cool people. we've got some great people that have come forward, and some of them are motivated by ideas of doing something to help out in the area of poverty. Some of them have great skills. We've got a filmmaker that's part of our community, and he's completed one small film and is working on another one, and he's a Juno Award winning video maker who is just part of our community. That's what he does. And we have other people with skills that they want to bring in and do something to make things work better in the community. And then we have people that have come to our community because they're hungry, because they don't have a place to live, and they've connected with us. And so wherever people connect from, we kind of recognize that all of us have a need to receive something, and all of us have a need to give something. And so we try to create a context where that can happen for those of us that are well off. Sometimes we don't know what we need, and we show up, and we may not need a meal, but we may have an encounter with a person that reveals, oh, I didn't know I needed that, and I need to belong somewhere as well.
How did it start?
Well, it's a kind of a neat story. It was some women in Port Hope, and there was a particular situation of poverty, a residential motel that had developed a reputation as one of the most difficult cases of poverty anywhere in Northumberland County, and it was in Port Hope. And a young woman who lived nearby would walk by, and she encountered some of the folks, and she recognized that these people are really struggling, and she wondered if there was something that she could do to help, or some of her friends. And she just started having conversations, went back to some women at her church and said, hey, maybe we can do something here. And that led to about three women connecting with that community and starting a little potluck meal once a week. And that was the summer of 2006. And 8 years later now, we're that weekly meal continues as kind of the centerpiece to our community.
I understand this evening is the usual evening for the meal. You're missing it just to be here. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. I had to make arrangements to escape from dinner tonight. But yeah, every Wednesday from 6 till about 7, we have a community dinner at St. John's Hall in Port Hope. And like I say, that has become kind of the centerpiece for what we do. That's a good and bad thing. The good part of it is is what it is, which is really something great. But it confuses people sometimes because we think of a free meal as being something like a soup kitchen and that sort of charity model. But if you came to our dinner tonight, or if you were there tonight, what you would see is a group again of a mixed group of people. Some people in very serious need, some people who are homeless, and some people who are not so much. And they're all lining up at a buffet table, serving themselves and sitting down to eat together. We don't serve people across the table, that kind of thing. And that's kind of core to what we do, that we do it together. And it's as much about the social connection, developing relationship, developing trust with each other, as it is about the particulars of putting on a meal.
I'd like to start talking a bit about homelessness, because I know you're very much involved in this issue, and you started to talk a bit about it, about the difference between rural and urban homelessness. And over the summertime, a study was released from the University of Calgary, where they interviewed 22 communities under 25,000 from across rural Canada, and they came to the conclusion that rural homelessness, rural areas, are distinct compared to the types of homelessness found in urban centers. Could you maybe enlighten us how it's different?
Sure. Yeah, I think in my experience is mostly in rural small town poverty. So I'm sort of going with a general understanding of urban poverty. But some of the differences are in a small community. It's usually the people have grown up in that community, and there's a little bit of pride still, even though they're struggling, and so they're not. I often say you don't panhandle in your own hometown. You find other ways to make things work. In a small town like Cobourg or Port Hope, it's sort of a nice place to live, and people like it that way. And so if they see somebody sleeping on the street, they're more likely to call the police and say there's a problem here. There's someone sleeping on the street, and the police sort of have to respond to that. Where in the city, if someone were sleeping on the street, and you just carry on, and there are services available in the cities, and that's probably the biggest difference. The numbers produce the services that respond to some of those things, and so the negatives are that in a small community, poverty, homelessness tend to be hidden. And tend to be harder for the people to connect with services that might be able to help.
One of the things the study found speaks to some of what you've already said: the lack of social programs, poor local economy, lack of affordable housing. But they talk about it in terms of the complexity of the problem, and I was wondering what you see locally when. How complex is it? Is it something that can be dealt with simply, or what aspects do we have to get at to start to address homelessness in Northumberland?
I hope there isn't a simple solution that I'm missing, because it would be really nice to have one. But the reality is it's complex, and the reasons for poverty and homelessness are a wide range of things. But one of the big overriding things that contributes to homelessness is just the general economic situation and shifts in the economy. And in Northumberland, we've had a bit of a shift downward away from things like manufacturing jobs and that kind of thing. So there's a bit of a shift downward. A city like Calgary has a real homelessness problem. It's become quite critical because they've had a shift upward. And in that shifting, somebody gets lost in that. And it's usually the people that are at the low end of the economic scale. But in I kind of lost track of where we were going there.
No, it's perfectly fine. What we were talking about is the complexity of the issue of homelessness in a rural area.
Yeah, and so the general economic conditions, and then the specific conditions of how much housing do you have, and in Northumberland right now, it looks to us like there aren't enough places for people to live, and that's one of the reasons that that people are homeless, because there aren't enough places to go around. And then when you have that kind of economic situation, that shortage of housing, it becomes more and more difficult to find affordable housing that's actually affordable to people who are living in poverty. And so that's kind of the secondary part. And then the last and the most complex is the personal reasons. There can be health considerations. Somebody had a fire. Somebody developed a chronic disease, and things like mental health and addiction are large pieces of the puzzle that it's not just about nuts and bolts. It's not just about a roof. It's about what you need to maintain a roof and what you need to maintain housing.
You know, most people are aware, or maybe they're not, that the Northumberland County actually has an affordable housing strategy, and a strategy also to deal with homelessness. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that study and what it's proposing.
Yeah, the county produced a 10-year housing and homelessness plan, and this was something that was done in each municipality across Ontario last year, and ours indicates basically what I've told you. There aren't enough houses to go around. It indicates that there doesn't seem to be government funding to create new housing, and on the sort of the bottom end of the scale of people most at risk, we don't have enough shelter space, and we don't have enough in the way of responses to homelessness, and that there not many solutions were proposed to address that. And so it sort of leaves it to if the government isn't going to do something about this, it kind of leaves it to the community to recognize that something creative needs to be done to solve the homelessness issue.
One of the things I've talked to you about this before is understanding the scope of homelessness. And it's fine to say there's an affordable housing inventory and we have transitional housing. I mean, we can point to certain programs going on in the community that are supposed to deal with this. But do we have any idea of just how many people in Northumberland are homeless?
Yeah, that's a tricky thing. According to the county's numbers, about 2,500 households in Northumberland County are either in a cycle of homelessness or at risk of homelessness. And so that's a large group of people who are living at a place where if they're not homeless now, they're likely to be over the course of the year. And maybe it would be helpful to define homelessness first of all, because that's one of the difficulties that the term homeless has become sort of a caricature of some older guy living on the street in Toronto, sleeping in a sleeping bag on the sidewalk. And homelessness, in the way we define it, is anyone who doesn't have a physical address in their own name. And the Homeless Hub, which is a research hub at York University, have created a Canadian definition of homelessness, and they created four main categories. And all four of those they consider to be homeless in Canada. And so one is street homelessness or absolute homelessness, which we have in Northumberland County. And the numbers of those are relatively small. I was working with probably 10 people over the past few months in Cobourg, Port Hope area who are sleeping rough is what we call it, outdoors. And then the next category is the people who are provisionally accommodated. So they're sleeping on somebody's couch or somebody's floor. They don't actually have an address in their name, and they're bunking in, they're sleeping in somebody's shed, things like that. So they're not outdoors, but they're not in a secure place. They're not not in a place that is theirs that they can count on tomorrow or next week. And then we have people who are temporarily housed in shelters, because we think of shelters as being a response. But typically a shelter is a place where you can stay for 30 days or so. And so we have Transition House in Coburg, and we have a couple of women's shelters in the county. But those are sort of a 30-day option. And then you have to be somewhere else.
Now, being homeless, also living in those kinds of conditions, whether it's, as you say, living rough or in a transitional housing or couch surfing, having temporary housing, there are many disadvantages to these people, just in terms of getting other forms of help to get them on their feet, because they don't have an address, they don't have, therefore they may not have proper identification. It makes it harder for them to get into the system, so that they can get the aid and the help that they need to kind of get on their feet. What have you seen when you're out there working with these kinds of people? What's been your experience with that?
Yeah, that definitely is the problem. And across that spectrum, and that spectrum can include people who actually have a roof over their head now, but they're one check away from losing that, or they're one big bill away from losing that. And so homelessness tends to be episodic in a small community like this. People are homeless for a while, they shift around in those categories that we just talked about. But what we're seeing is that as people cycle through those things, they're not getting ahead. They're not getting health care. We're working right now to answer your earlier question too. We're trying to find a better answer to how many homeless people there are, and so we're working with the health unit right now and the Affordable Housing Committee to actually document how many people are homeless, and we've got about 50 surveys in now. And those people talk about what their income source is, and something like 20% of them have no income at all, because if you don't have an address, you can't get welfare, and so you're kind of out there. But those people are using probably a third of those people had used ambulances, emergency services, police services over in 2014. And so we've got sometimes people think if we do nothing about homelessness, it saves us money. But overall, not addressing homelessness is really expensive for us.
Can you describe for me? I mean, I can't even put my head around what it's like to try and do a survey of homeless people. Mm. How do you do? Because, you know, if they're moving and they're in transition and they don't have an address, how do you actually go about that?
It comes back to what I was talking about in Greenwood Coalition and some other agencies that are able to develop relationships with people. It really is about that and trust and knowing where they are. And so my work as an outreach worker is going to where people live and where they are, and to be able to work with them in a non-judgmental way allows us to develop a relationship. And so we work with somebody who's homeless, and they say, oh, well, you should talk to my friend over here, because they're in a tough situation as well. And so those people, yeah, you're right, they aren't moving ahead. They're stuck in a place, and what I see more and more is they can't get out of that place on their own when they're in that spot.
Incredible. You know, you were saying earlier, poverty costs us. In the Rethink Poverty study, poverty costs our household, each household in this county, $2,300 to $2,900 a year for this kind of thing. We're going to take a bit of a break now, and we're going to hear for some commercials, and then we're going to hear a tune by John Lennon, Stand By Me, special request from Dave Sheffield.
As a local business owner, would you pay to advertise your service in a shotgun approach to a broad market or to an audience that is right for your business? Would you try and promote your business into another area code where there's three others doing what you do, or into your hometown where you're known as one of a kind? Northumberland 89.7 is specific and local for the people of Northumberland County. Northumberland 89.7 is unique and original, just like your business. Give us a call at 905-372-2391 or email us at sales@northumberland897.ca.
I'm here with Ed White, on the job. were inside my refrigerator. And guess what?
It was a minor repair, well worth fixing, for far less than a new one.
Thanks, Ed. That's Ed White, Appliances, 51 Mill Street South, Port Hope, 885-7109.
That was Stand By Me by John Lennon. I'm Robert Washburn, and this is The Drive Time. Consider This Live. And I'm with David Sheffield, an outreach worker for the Greenwood Coalition. Thanks for coming on tonight, Dave. We've been talking about homelessness and its impact. Now, during the break, you were starting to talk a bit about charity versus social justice. You know, we were getting pretty negative there, pretty down. I mean, these are tough issues to talk about. But maybe on a lighter note or a more positive note, at the very least, what's the difference between charity and social justice, and why do we need to think about this as a community?
Well, charity is, I mean, we generally have a good feeling about the term, but we usually don't want to accept it ourselves. I don't need your charity, that kind of thing. A picture of charity, I see charity as a transaction, and it's necessary sometimes. But you walk by somebody panhandling on the street, and they put out the Tim Hortons cup, and you drop a toonie in it and go on your way. And what just happened there is a charity transaction. One person humbled themselves to ask for something, and they got $2 in return. you were walking down the street and you tossed $2 into the cup and you felt better about yourself and went on your way. But nothing has changed. That person's still on the street. They maybe got a coffee out of it, but nothing has changed to make things work better for them or for you or the community. Social justice is about asking, what can we do so that one person doesn't have to beg for help on the street? What can we do that makes things work for all of us in a community? And there are a lot of things that can happen there. And that's where we're coming from at Greenwood Coalition, is trying to find some better, particularly human situations. And so we're very much on the grassroots level. But the other place that those questions need to be asked is a little higher up the chain, when we look at governments and sort of how things are working. We're very much on a charity model, but we pay out welfare and different things like that. But it's not necessarily working well. It's not changing anything. And you referred to some studies earlier that if we look closely at some of those, they indicate that there's actually better ways to do this.
So what we're really talking about here, another metaphor that's often used is, you know, you can give a man a fish and feed him for a day, or you can teach a man to fish and he can survive for a lifetime.
Exactly.
That interesting. In talking about that then, in terms of charity, here we are at Christmas time. And I was doing a bit of looking back, and back about a year ago, you wrote an article for the 4th and 1/5. And in it, you were talking about Christmas and this time of year and poverty. And you said, for anyone living in poverty, the messy reality of life, complete with pretty lights and piped-in carols, make for a pretty difficult time. How so?
The thing about Christmas, I mean, we any of us have experienced sort of what's really wonderful about Christmas, and you know, the Christmas TV special kind of thing, and that warm feeling and that sort of thing. But most of us have also had the disappointment at Christmas time, some of the difficult things, the emotions that come up, and for people who are living in poverty, those same things happen, but they can be quite exaggerated. And so, for example, you live in a community that's relatively prosperous, and everyone's going around shopping, and there are ads going everywhere about, you know, how to make a perfect Christmas, and you sort of hope that maybe this could be one of a Christmas like that, or you just, you know, give up completely. But if you're hoping for it, and then you know, Christmas comes and you realize, oh no, it's just like it was before, and it's difficult, and then, you know, family situations are intensified, and there's just a lot of things that remind you that you're poor. And I always think of the Merle Haggard song, "If We Make It Through December." It's that time of year that it could be wonderful, but if it's not, it can be really lonely. And a number of years ago, we got involved with some folks and started the Christmas dinner on Christmas Day that continues in both Cobourg and Port Hope. And at Christmas time, there's often, you know, charitable things that are happening, you know, meals, community things happening. But on Christmas Day, if you don't have somewhere to be, whether you're, you know, in financial need or you're lonely, whatever the situation is, Christmas can be a really difficult time. And so having a place to go and some food to eat and some people to spend time with can make the difference.
So hard to think about that too, because especially this time of year, I mean, when you're looking around, you know, lots of places to donate. There's food drives, there's toy drives for the kids, all these things going on. And it seems very intense at this time of year. But when you reflect then on the rest of the year, the other 11 months, how would you describe the community's attitude towards poverty?
The community, particularly in Port Hope, where we've been working for the past 8 years, it's really been quite remarkable. And the way I put it is that when people in a community like Port Hope find out that they have neighbors in need, that they're struggling, they want to do something about that. They want to help in whatever way they can. They often don't know what to do, and what we've done has been a bit of a catalyst for that. And so I mentioned our community dinner that we do every week. it started as a group of people putting together a meal. Now it's a roster of 9 or 10 churches and service groups in the community that take turns putting on that meal. There'll be somewhere around 80, 90 people there tonight at that dinner, and they put on that meal, and I call it the feast of the week. It's just a really great meal. This isn't some kind of thin soup or and a crust of bread. It's a really good meal with gravy, and that is what that reflects is the response of Port Hope to a situation of poverty, and essentially we just have to say, here's a need, and people come forward.
You talk a lot about Port Hope, but I know you have experience elsewhere. What do you see in other places, other corners of the county?
Yeah, most of our experience has been in Port Hope, and so my experience in other parts of the county, I mean, Port Hope and Coburg, there actually isn't a Berlin Wall between the two towns. You might think so talking to some people, but people go back and forth, and so again, as our work is based on relationships, and so we tend to follow where people are. And so the situation is very similar across the county, and we're part of some multi-agency committees that work together, affordable housing, et cetera. And so we get a picture of what's happening in other places. And I've really come to believe that these responses need to be localized, and even looking at countywide is a bit too much. And so we've got a most of what we do is in Port Hope, and it's deeply engaged in that community now, and I think that we're it's kind of a bold experiment we're involved in, but we think that it's a model for what could happen in other communities. It could be repeated in other communities very easily.
That's interesting. So you're saying that even to look at it at a county level, where poverty is as a responsibility municipally, politically, you're saying that it's got to come down a level to maybe the council, the town, the hamlet, the village. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. How well do you think a community can respond in that regard? Because, I mean, it does take a lot of resources, and often that's why it's at the level it's at, because it does take so many resources. How can small communities respond in that way?
That's not a simple question, but I just have to keep coming back to what works for us. What works for us is developing a relationship with another human being and recognizing the common humanity that we share, and trying to find a solution for that. And we're living in a time when people are living on welfare in Port Hope, and they're getting a check for $650, and they're renting a room for $550. They've got $100 to live on, and so that's sort of the government response, and that's not really adequate to live a life. That's not supporting someone to move out of that, and so we have to look beyond that, and that's where the community can be creative. And when you have a relationship with someone, what has happened is a group of people have become neighbors, and so I'm walking down the street. I'm not a good example. Somebody in our community is walking down the street, and there's a person that is struggling with poverty, who they've met and maybe had dinner with a few times, and they run into them down the street, and they know this person by name. They know something of their story, and if they stop and talk to them, acknowledge them, that changes the community. But also, there may be some simple thing that they can do that helps that person get from A to B, and that is something that is sustainable. It's something that we can all participate in, and it's something that doesn't raise anybody's taxes.
Interesting. You're talking about things being done on a local level. I know you were part of something called the Rethink Health, a day in my neighbor's life event just recently. And I wonder, when you watch politicians and community leaders go through an exercise like this, how do you think it affects them?
That's a really good question. We should ask them that. But I think I participated in that day, and essentially the group was divided up into 12 groups, and each one had a scenario of someone living in poverty, and they had to do some problem solving using real numbers and real situations. And there were a couple politicians at my table, and I think that it. I think it demonstrates for them what the actual struggle is. And I think most people, wherever they work, went away from that day recognizing, I really don't know what it's like to live in poverty. I really don't. I don't know how if I were in that situation, I'm not sure I would have a simple way out of that.
Does that kind of an experience, do you think it impacts on policy?
I hope so. I mean, that's why we do these things. Over the past while, I feel like we've had some improving engagement with the folks at the political level, where there's a willingness to try to understand what's going on, and I think part of that comes from the way that we've been able to have a to bring the voice of that struggling community forward a little bit. And so we've got people with lived experience who can articulate, this is what life is like for me. This is what the struggles are. This is what works and doesn't work. And this week we've got, we're working with Trinity College School and their Week Without Walls program. And we've got, I think there's 5 students working with a nurse from the health unit to look at warming room spaces that would be available in Port Hope for people to use during the day, and putting together some survival kits for people who don't have a place to go overnight that can be distributed through the police, et cetera. And one of our community members who's participating in that project with them this week was himself homeless outdoors in February this year when I met him. Young person, and the pieces just fell apart and there was nowhere to go, and he was given a winter survival kit that wasn't really adequate for being outdoors, and this person has in a position where they're not homeless at the moment and are able to help out and nice. Be a credible source of information. And so I think that is really significant when people who have had these struggles, who have been in these situations, are empowered to have a voice I think that may affect policy.
In your time as an outreach worker, have you ever been part of an experience where you've seen a politician and somebody connect in a way where it really transforms the politician?
I saw that this fall. For 3 days in October, we were part of the Homeless Happens Here camp out to bring attention to homelessness in the community. And we camped out for 3 days in Memorial Park, right in downtown Port Hope, beside the town hall, and that became our community. It was mostly the Greenwood community people who were sleeping overnight there, but we also had healthcare professionals and sleeping in a tent next to somebody who was actually sleeping outdoors the night before and was after the camp out. But during that time, it was during the municipal election, we invited politicians to come in. And I think we had 13 or 14 politicians who came in and sat at a round table. And it really was a wonderful thing to see the folks from our community who have experience talking to some of those politicians. And some great ideas came forward. And it felt very sincere on the part of the politicians. They were listening, and they were, I got the sense that this was new to them. This wasn't comfortable for them, but they wanted to do something about it. And so we've kept those conversations going, and it sort of feels like there may be some wheels turning where we have an ongoing dialogue, particularly with the new Port Hope Council. And so it'll be interesting to see what that turns into. And so there was somebody there at that session that described what the importance of was of meeting with your municipal council, and that is that the people on the street, the grassroots people, they can walk up to the town hall and they can bring their needs there, and they can dialogue with that person, or they run into them in the coffee shop, and then that person can take those needs on up and advocate at the provincial and federal level for what's actually needed in that community. So that dialogue with the municipal politician really is one of the most important dialogues.
That goes back to your earlier point about the importance of keeping it local and making these changes at a micro level. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. We're going to take a bit of a break right now and pay some bills. But before we break, just some more interesting statistics. 1 in 5 children in Northumberland live in poverty. 300 people live in shelters across this county, and 350 families are waiting between 3 and 4 years on the waiting list for housing in Northumberland. We'll be right back.
For over 35 years, Northumberland Security Incorporated has been providing everything necessary for physical and electronic security. From locks, alarms, safes, access control to surveillance systems, and handicap door operators. We are virtually a one-stop personal and property security center, operating from Pickering to Peterborough to Picton and everywhere in between. Visit us at 22 King Street West in Coburg, online at northumberlandsecurity.com, or call 905-372-8951, the professional security team.
All right, we're back. And before we go on too much further, I'd like to get to know a little bit more about you, David. Where did you grow up?
Well, I spent my childhood in northern Ontario, north of Lake Superior, Thunder Bay, Scriber, that sort of thing. And then sort of my teenage years and beyond in eastern Ontario. And so I lived in situations where there was poverty around. This isn't something that I pictured doing with my life, but in looking back, I can understand sort of how I've ended up here.
Have you experienced poverty firsthand?
Not me personally. I've lived, I think, pretty comfortably through my life. My father was a music teacher, and growing up, there were struggles. We weren't well off financially, but we were part of a well connected community. And I think I've come to understand a little bit more about different kinds of poverty now. And so probably in the early years in Northern Ontario, we lived in a materially poorer way than we did later, but we were not we didn't experience the kind of poverty that others experience, and things like loneliness and disconnection and some of those things are just as significant in holding people back from being successful, doing what they need to do next, as is material poverty.
What in your early life has influenced the work that you do today?
Well, I mentioned my father was a music teacher. He was also sort of a lay minister, and our house was always a place where anyone was welcome, and we had a number of people from all different situations, often challenging situations, who were part of our home life, there was going back to, I guess it would be in the late 60s somewhere, there was a family across the road that in my looking back on it now, I realize this was a family that lived in poverty, and there was domestic violence, and a husband that worked in the woods and came back and drank and beat his wife, and my parents reached out to that family, and and made them feel welcome, and in the end helped this woman as she was able to sort of stand up to that situation, and that that person and another and a friend of his eventually broke into our house and beat my father in the house, and so there were experiences like that where in looking back I sort of recognize that some things are worth doing. Some things are sometimes it's costly to do the right thing. But my parents stay in touch with that family today, and life is different for them because of a neighbor reached out across the road and made them feel welcome and gave them a way forward.
How in the midst of all of that that you grew up with, I mean, it could have been so easy to have turned another way and said, you know, I don't want to have anything more. I want to get ahead in the world and go ahead. How did you develop, or where does your sense of compassion and empathy come from?
I think I did say that for a long time, Robert, but I think for me there's a spiritual basis to what motivates me, an understanding of the world and our place in it as created beings, and I think for a lot of the people that work with us, some kind of motivation like that is behind what they do. I don't have simple answers to these things. I think in looking at what I do, it just seems really simple at this point. People are people. We share this common humanity. We have an opportunity to develop a relationship with each other and help each other. And I'm helped in this work as much as I do any helping. And so that two-way relationship of human community is just feels natural to me, and I don't think I spend a lot of time asking why.
Oh, interesting. When you come to the end of a day and you're putting your head down on the pillow and you're reflecting over the work that you've done in that day, what goes through your head?
First of all, gratitude. I'm incredibly thankful to be able to do this work, to make this my work. And somebody asked me a little while ago that was going through a career change. What would I do if this weren't my job? If I didn't have this job, what would I do? And I said I'd spend my time trying to figure out how to get this job back again. to be able to work with the people that I work with. In talking about the difficulties of living in poverty and some of the social challenges that people experience, you can look at that in a negative way. But my day-to-day experience is really one of optimism and of hope. And the wonderful stories that I am able to bear witness to are what keep me going, and I sleep well at night.
I bet you do. So let's talk about the future and about action. Let's end on a positive note. Where do we go from here? What's next?
Well, there's plenty to do for sure. But in some ways, I feel like for us at Greenwood Coalition, keeping on with what we're doing is really important. Which that core work of developing relationships with people, finding ways that people can be included and find some empowerment. On the bigger scale of things, we really need to ask ourselves what is our society going to look like when we have an economy that shuts out a lot of people? A lot of the people that I'm working with aren't going back to full employment. That's not a scenario that we can foresee in this community at this time. And so we have to ask, what are we going to do? And where do we find our identity? That's one of the biggest pieces that is challenged by poverty. People lose their identity, and from there, it's really difficult to find your way back on your own.
So, what do people in the community need to do then? What can they do to help find this identity, find this way back?
The first thing you can do is look people in the eye when you see them, and if it's a stranger or somebody who seems to be struggling even more so, but people need to ask questions of politicians. People need to become informed. There are lots of things to do. We're talking about the difference between charity and social justice. There's still charity work that needs to be done. It's not the ultimate answer, but in the short term, we're running this One Warm Coat program right now that distributes free coats, adult coats to people through the winter, and we've still got to drive on for that. And there are needs. The food bank continue. Food banks are a bad idea. Food banks should be out of business, but unfortunately, they're not, because the structures that we have mean that we need food banks. So the food banks still need food.
And what should businesses be doing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that we need to take a look at communities. There's a cool thing. Tamarack Institute, Research Institute, has a program called Vibrant Communities, and we've been looking at that, because there's some really interesting models of bringing the social agency, the private, the general community, and private business and government together to sit around a table and find solutions for that community, and that really needs to happen. We all need to be engaged in the well-being of our community.
Well, the last question I was going to ask you is, what do politicians need to do? But before I'm going to let you answer that, I'm going to say, wait, and I'm going to have you come back and talk to us some more, because I've really, really enjoyed this conversation tonight, David. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a joy talking to you.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure, Robert. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, absolutely outstanding. And this is Robert Washburn, and we've been on The Drive Time. Consider this live. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And hopefully next week when we get back, Dave Glover will be here to join us, and we'll be talking more about politics and life in Northumberland County. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Hey, Northumberland, this is